You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 295, the most pointless jobs in the world, Life of Pi, the Great Sutton Bake Off, and the legend of record club suppers. Disco with chicken in a basket, maybe? No idea. It's all coming up after Aha and Take On Me.
I couldn't resist picking that. I must have heard it on an advert or something recently, and I just think that's such an inspiring tune. I love how positive it is and how kind of it feels like a plane taking off. And also, I'm quite fond of the fact that Ed Miliband picked it as one of his 8 Desert Island discs, which I thought was quite sweet. Really, it was a nice kind of refreshing change from David Cameron picking Smith's records, which I suspect he might not have ever heard before, and Gordon Brown pretending to like the Arctic Monkeys. I felt that Ed really did like that record, and I thought that was good. So Aha, Alan Partridge's favourite band, I assume, and Take On Me.
Yeah, really innovative video as well in the early days of MTV. Yeah. On rotation, as they say, on MTV in the 80s. Welcome to the Parish Council podcast. It's episode 295, brought to you by the Media Motel and the Rocking Vicar. I'm Terence Stackham, and don't take on her.
Hey.
Oh, dear. Aha, it's Juliet Harris.
Hello, everyone.
There's no doubt that the ever-increasing range of digital services available in our lives has brought great progress and convenience to our lives. So we've instant access to news, information, entertainment. Shopping can be undertaken with a couple of clicks, few words perhaps to an Amazon Echo. But humans being humans, there's always a bunch of people seeking to exploit new ways of living. The explosion of social media has seen an enormous rise in jobs in the digital sector, some of them perfectly legitimate, no doubt. But since the early days of Twitter, I've occasionally been checking out this bloke from London who describes himself as a Twitter expert. But the trouble is, he speaks really badly in a way that puts the listener on edge. And he's written a guide that he has on his website, an e-book, if you will, on how, and I quote, to get an endless stream of business leads and opportunities from Twitter. But his book, I had skimmed through it there earlier today, his book is full of grammatical errors and typos and poor editing. But here's the thing, he's still at it, because when Sky News Google Twitter expert, he's there in all his self-appointed glory. I'm also wary, Jules, of people who describe themselves as life coaches, internet gurus, and brand promoters.
Absolutely, yeah. I could totally agree with these Emperor's New Clothes things. I've got a friend who once was a Word, people might remember him as Man of Soup. He was a contributor to the Word blog. Mm. And I remember him saying once, and we were having lunch somewhere, we were talking about something, and he said, well, where does she work? And I said, I think she works in advertising or marketing. And he went, yes, one of the professions the middle classes have made up for themselves. And actually, when it comes down to it, advertising and marketing are extremely legitimate when you compare this to, you know, sort of our freelance avocado experts of the new social media age. I think there's something to be said for, I think the thing that annoys me about this is that there is the germ of a legitimate thing in there with some of these things. And actually, I think that coaching is actually a really valuable tool. And I've had a bit of business coaching before, and that's been really useful and really helpful. And I think that to have some kind of guidance in that respect is can be really helpful. But of course, if you know, like you say, if someone spots an opportunity to make money, then often it becomes invaded by charlatans rather than necessarily people that have genuine concern and are genuinely good at those skills. So yes, I do think of I particularly am cross about the clean eating industry.
Oh God! Yes.
And people, and I know that much has been written and said about this now already. But people that, and this is what makes me cross, because nutritionists are a genuine profession, I think, or at least for some diet, for some genuine, not, you know, I can't look at bread because it brings me out in hives, but you know, or it offends me. But you know, there are some. I've got a couple of friends who've had serious chronic stomach conditions for many years, Crohn's and things like that, who do have good relationships with nutritionists, who are genuinely medically trained and are really helpful in helping them to kind of discover what they can and can't eat, and that what exacerbates genuine, not life-threatening or even life-limiting, but just life-depressing conditions, I suppose. But for every genuine nutritionist who is really good, you now get 10 middle-class, double-barreled girls who are, you know, with various kind of aspirational-type Instagrams and things. And these people are held up as kind of quote-unquote experts. I was reading a piece in the New Statesman today about, by Felicity Cloak, who writes with The Guardian, she's excellent, about the kind of the ridiculousness of the online clean eating industry. And the fact is that, you know, that she found 22,000 results for hashtag avocado on toast and 7,500 results for hashtag bacon butty, although she suspected what was probably being eaten more of in real life. And she said some ridiculous statistic from a psychologist that specialised in eating disorders that said that 80-90% of his patients were on some sort of quote-unquote clean eating diet. So I agree with you that there are various kind of emperor's new clothes type non-professions which are making their way in the world. And I think that in the case of, you know, would-be nutritionists of clean eating fame, I think that's particularly dangerous, actually, particularly this point about eating disorders. I think it's such a... hashtag thinspiration is used a lot as well. It's a very, very thin line. Well, if you pardon the pun, it's a very thin line there. And yeah, that troubles me, I must admit.
You know, all these people that we're describing here, I always think of the monorail guy from your Simpsons, you know, the guy that comes into town and sells Springfield the notion of setting up their own monorail system.
Monorail.
So, I always felt sorry for the delightful Labour MP, Kerry McCarthy, because she was given...
Kerry, she's great.
She was given the title of Twitter Czar.
Oh, gosh. Remember, there was something to kill something. Yeah,
in the run-up to the 2010 general election. And I know it's a title she felt she could have done without, but I think it's a prime example of how these absurd descriptions kind of emerged in the early days of social media. And I do think it's absolutely remarkable that people are still trying to make a living as, like, Periscope gurus and Facebook mentors, Twitter influencers and so on. Well, you know, I just say, may they all end up influencing themselves in deciding whether to have porridge or toast for breakfast. That's what
indeed. I love the fact that's become the older person's way of dismissing, or the anti-social media person dismissing. My dad often says to me when my mum says up a dinner, I suppose you're going to tweet about this. It's his favourite. Or, you know, am I going on Instagram? Have I gone viral yet? My dad often says to me when I'm on social media, or obviously using my phone. So and then follows it with, well, have I gone viral yet? That's what we had when we were children. So yeah, I think there are still, I don't want to get into this reductive way of saying that, you know, only people that work in proper professions that I recognise have real jobs, because I think there are lots of different ways to make a living, and that's often where the true innovators come through, by you know, thinking about new things. I mean, you know, if Steve Jobs had said 25 years ago, I'm going to get rich and famous by designing an operating system which you know, everyone will carry around a tiny computer in their pocket, people would go, oh, for goodness sake, don't be so nuts, you know, and don't, you know, another wacko recreating a non-job, and look at where that went. So I don't want to dismiss things out of hand, but like you say, it's the charlatan element of it that I have a bit of an issue with.
Now, as we record this podcast, Wayne Shaw is no longer reserve team goalkeeper or coach for Sutton United Football Club. A big fuss over a small pie. Should he get his job back? That's next, after Paul McCartney.
And when I knew we were going to do this story, I obviously thought about what pie-themed tunes that I knew. I was tempted by the theme to Rhubarb and Custard, not least because it's an instrumental, so I knew that Terence would doubly appreciate that.
No.
But I know, hey, but I genuinely think that Flaming Pie by Paul McCartney, which that was, that was the title track from his album, and I got it for my birthday, I think, in my 13th birthday in 1997 on tape, which I've still got somewhere. And I think it's a really good album, actually. I think it's a rather underrated album of his. It's got The Young Boy, I think, was the lead-off single from it. But there's some really nice tracks on it, and I quite like that kind of barroom kind of bluesy thing that he does there. I think it's quite good.
It's sadly the last Paul McCartney project to feature Linda, of course.
Yes, of course. Yeah, she's on A Great Day, which is what she sings on that. But the last track on the album, I think, is lovely. So
yeah,
it's a lovely...
It is. It was hugely successful as well. It was one of his last sort of new products that you know, made, I think it was number two off the top of my head in Billboard.
Yes, it did
really
well,
yeah. If we ever needed a couple of examples of how football is now just big business, we've just heard news of the shabby sacking of Claudio Ranieri at Leicester.
Just as we were taking to the air, actually, which is it's amazing how short people's memories are, isn't it, really? And my friend made the point on Twitter, and I don't think it's a bad one, that he took a side of fairly mediocre players in some cases and managed to mould something to make it, you know, to win the league completely unexpectedly. Players like Drinkwater, not, you know, perhaps going to set the world on fire otherwise. And obviously he may have lost the dressing room by the sound of it, but I think some of those players might be minded to remember, you know, the Vardas of this world, what life was like before they were big stars, and how, you know, what goes up must eventually, you know, perhaps literally go down again.
Isn't it peculiar, because 2 years ago Chelsea won the Premiership League title, the following season it all collapsed, we were flirting with relegation, and Mourinho gets sacked, albeit a bit earlier in the season, just before Christmas. In that very season, Leicester win the title, and the following season, they're flirting with relegation, even more so than Chelsea. And
this is even worse than the curse of the Mercury Prize, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? It's the most peculiar thing. On Monday of this week, Arsenal beat non-league Sutton United 2-0 in an FA Cup tie. I was watching the game on television, found myself a little bit annoyed as towards the end of the game, the TV cameras focused on the admittedly rather portly reserve goalkeeper for Sutton.
23 Stone, isn't he?
Absolutely,
like that.
As he chomped on a pie. Now, I was a bit saddened as I felt the commentary was a little bit mocking, and I thought this was an example, you know, sort of fat shaming by the BBC, which I'm not a fan of, that sort of thing.
No.
So inevitably, in my kind of ire, I popped onto Twitter to see if anybody else was talking about it, and immediately discovered that the whole pie-eating business was something of a setup, as bets had been taken by a gambling company of odds of 8-1 that the goalkeeper, Wayne Shaw, would eat a pie during the game. Since then, Sutton United has taken a dim view, the Football Association are investigating, and Wayne Shaw has tearfully resigned from his role at the club. Now, do you support Wayne Shaw, Jules, or is the petition to have him reinstated merely pie in the sky?
Ah, that's very good indeed. I wondered to how many places he can recite pie, etc. No, I don't know if just be pie man or not, really. One thing it does highlight, excuse me, I can't remember exactly who wrote it, but there was a piece in the Telegraph today basically saying this is shone a light on the really sort of difficult, uncomfortable relationship between football and gambling. Uncomfortable in the sense that it made the writer and me feel very uncomfortable as well, that either 11 or 13 of the top flight clubs are sponsored by betting companies of some sort or another now from different points of the world. Like you, I was rather charmed by the pie eating thing. I thought it was quite funny. I thought it was just kind of witty satire. And no, it turned out to be a sort of a pie thing. Just to stay on topic, but to give an anecdotal thing, I go to a weekly business networking meeting that's a breakfast meeting that starts at 6:30 in the morning.
So
I know. And then I do Indie Wonderland in the evening. Oh, so I'm about ready to kill by 10:15 on Wednesdays. But they're delightful people, and it's always very nice to see people. And a different person has to do a presentation this week. And the profile at the beginning, you have to say who you are. You write out a thing, and the person that introduced you reads and says who you are, and you know where you live and what your previous work was and who your family are and stuff like that. And it always ends with a fact that nobody nobody knows about me. And the person, the chap that was about to do a mortgage presentation, the person introduced him said, the things that you don't know about him, there are odds of 8-1 that Andy will eat a pie during this presentation. And unfortunately, he didn't, which was a pity. But no, so I mean, in one sense, it is quite funny. But in another sense, it was a daft thing to do. And as this Telegraph person said, it was rather a pity that Sutton had, started off as plucky underdogs, and they did so well. I mean, you can't overstate how well they did to get to the last 16 of the FA Cup. I think it's a phenomenal achievement, and I was so pleased they got a big team, they got their big day. But they've made themselves, all of them, not just the pie chap, but everyone has made themselves look a bit kind of shabby, really, because they made themselves look like they weren't really bothered when it came down to it. And, 2-0 down already. And it was, and also the Sun, the sponsorship by the Sun stuck in my craw a bit as well, I must admit. And it just, they just seemed, they seemed a bit unbothered by it, really. And Gary Lineker, I mean, I don't think, I thought it was a daft thing to do. Who knows who he knew that had money on that? I don't particularly think, I don't want to think that he did it deliberately to make a lot of money. Even if he didn't, it was still a thoughtless thing to do. But I think the Telegraph are right that it shone a light on how in hock, if you pun intended, the football industry is to the, and it is an industry now, isn't it, to the gambling industry. Gary Lineker, who is unofficial leader of the opposition at the moment, I think he's sharing the title with Sadiq Khan, leader of the free world. He tweeted about this, and I was in the odd position of not agreeing with Gary Lineker.
That's unusual.
Which is very strange, because in many ways I enjoy his Twitter contributions. I think often they're very nuanced, and I think he's obviously a clever chap and thoughtful is how I would describe him usually. He says, so Wayne Shaw, who slept on a sofa 3 nights a week at Sutton to maintain and run the place, loses his job over hashtag Piegate, FFS. I won't explain what that stands for. He says, day by day, football is losing its heart and its sense of humour. And he went on to say, basically he's had a bit of a rant about it and says that he doesn't, yes, it's losing its heart and its sense of humour, to which I would argue, surely the fact that betting companies are crawling all over football in the first place shows to me that it's, it's not quite as clear cut as that, is it? Where are you, Gary, when it comes to confronting Ray Winstone's floating head at half time? You're not, it makes me think, yes, I am sorry that if he put so much in and he was got rid of, but it was a supremely stupid thing to do that put Sutton in a ridiculous position that made them look very stupid and unbothered. And I can kind of see, it wasn't a very bright thing to do, but I actually quite liked Sutton's initial reaction, which was, he's been a bit of a big head and the attention's gone to his head, but we're still bringing that down to earth. I thought that was quite nice, but I'm sorry that it hasn't followed through, really. But I feel a little bit sorry for the chap, although I think it was just an act of stupidity rather than an act of malevolence. But I don't think Gary's, I don't buy Gary's, people are ruining football. I tell you what's ruining football, stupid betting companies.
Oh, I feel so strongly about this and that aspect of it, because that huge growth, and in particular this influence of betting companies around football. My own club, Chelsea, often promotes on social media, and particularly on Twitter, what it calls its betting partner. And
clubs that aren't sponsored by betting still have these betting partners. Why do they need them? I don't understand.
Well, yeah, and on television, as you said, the Ray Winston thing, no football match can take place now on the commercial channels without an avalanche of advertising, stings, sponsorships by gambling companies.
I mean, Dad and I joke now that at half-time, we always, I think the pundit, because my dad always has had he doesn't gamble and is uncomfortable with anyone that does, including me, but he does have this kind of almost reverence. I think it comes from his horse racing youth, has this reverence towards bookmakers, because he's of the view that bookmakers want to make money, so he's inclined to trust what bookmakers say, perversely, because he feels they are untrustworthy. And he always says to me, the football pundit that he trusts the most and whose opinions that he's inclined to listen to, he says to me, what's Ray Winstone going to say at halftime? My dad's favourite football pundit, because, he says, what's Ray going to tell us? What does he think is going to happen next? And oddly, quote unquote Ray is right a lot of the time.
And they try and make it seem so sort of cool and trendy and hipster and beardy and everything. But the thing is, gambling can bring so much misery into people's lives, as much as drug misuse and excessive reliance on alcohol, because you know the betting companies are prepared to pay big dollar, and so we not only tolerate, but we seem to be encouraging their influence. And I was very much taken this week by a report in the Daily Mirror that claimed that bookmakers are taking in £34 million each week from those crack cocaine gambling machines in betting shops.
And still, I mean, people that don't agree with the new Labour governments and Tony Blair wang on and on and on about Iraq and PFI and various things. But actually, one of the things that upset me the most about New Labour, and one of its biggest mistakes, I think, was its deregulation of the gambling industry.
Absolutely. These things are
that was a huge error.
I completely agree. FOBTs, fixed odds betting terminals, and they're destroying people. It's
awful.
A kind of hidden story. But their relationships, families, all being destroyed by these. And yet we treat the parent companies of these leeches as royalty, because they bring... They sort of bung money at TV to advertise their grimy services. And it's all dressed up, as I say, in this really cool, trendy, hipster short. You see these people betting on their apps, on their phones, in their sort of Shoreditch, Old Street, you know, apartments and so on. The reality is, it's people, bailiffs knocking at the door to take your television because, you owe all this money. I really do loathe that whole aspect of the link with sport.
Absolutely, and I find it, you know, it smacks of, you know, people that might have concerns about it. For example, the players, the PFA, the Players Association, and their Sporting Chance Clinic, and that's sort of helped footballers with gambling. You'd think someone from there might have something to say, but I do get the impression that people have had their mouths stuffed full of silver, really. And like I say, I'm uncomfortable to be in the position of disagreeing with Gary Lineker, but. One wonders.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. Record club suppers and creating menus around movies. That's next after The Coral.
It's up in my heart when it skips a beat. Can't feel no pavement out under my feet.
I do like The Coral, a splendid blend of Liverpudlian Motown and psychedelia.
They still are training, and they're still such a great band.
They are. That was released as a single from their first album in 2002. It reached number 13 in the UK, The Coral and Dreaming of You. Well, that Shakespeare bloke once wrote, "If music is the food of Arthur Lee, play on in Laurel Canyon." I think that's what he said. It was something like that. And ever since, the link between eating and entertainment has been well established. From dining at the Copa Room at the Sands Hotel in Vegas as Count Basie and Sinatra entertain the tables, to overpriced hot dogs at your local cinema. Food links sweetly with sound and vision, as your supper club proves, Jules.
Indeed, yes. And to say it's a record supper club, it sounds far more legitimate than it actually is, really. So some very nice friends of mine that tweet, they live in Bexhill, where I work, and they suggested we do something called Record Club Supper. It was originally four of us, and now it's expanded. There were five of us at the last one. And what you do is every person takes it in turns, and we do this every few months, takes it in turns to write categories. They are always slightly peculiar in name, because the idea is that they are all about the interpretation, really. So we go around to our friend's house, they cook a lovely meal, and we all take some wine. The alcohol element seems to play quite heavily, actually, to the point where we had a Christmas one, and we drank so much Prosecco, or Pisek, as it is known, that my hangover actually started on the train home. So it is better when we manage to rein it in a bit, I must admit. But we do this, and the idea is that we all take it in turns to play a record on this category, and you talk a little about why you picked it for that category, and then everyone scores out of 10 for each person, and you have to do it based on a mix of, well, I get annoyed because sometimes people score because they don't like the record, but actually I try and score, unless I tend to mark people down if I feel it is nothing to do with the category. Because for me, the category is king. So to give it an example of the records that you'd have to dig out of your bag in order to fulfil my category, or rather the categories you'd have to try and do. So my six that I picked are Song with a Story. So my pick for this was Harper Valley PTA by Jeannie C. Reilly. Someone else picked a Johnny Cash record. I did We're Number One, which I initially thought I might play something motivational, perhaps like Take On Me, for example. But everyone picked their favourite number ones, in fact. So I played Ghost Town by The Specials and scored 10s, which I was very pleased about. Computer Love, the winning record for that was someone played, my friend Dave played Window Licker by Aphex Twin, which was extremely bizarre but excellent. Now that's what I call landfill indie.
Oh, yes.
My favourite category.
Yeah.
I played a Kaiser Chiefs record. Fight the Power. I think I played Supermodel Superficial by the Voodoo Queens. I almost played Huggy Bear, so lots of people played some very angry records during that. That was very good. My favourite category, the general public are idiots. which I picked. I played a record that was kept off number one by Robson and Jerome. It was called Common People by Pulp. So I felt that this proved that the general public were idiots. So other people took the approach, they played records that they felt should have been very successful and weren't. I did wonder if someone might play Vienna by Ultravox and didn't, but that's where I was going with that. So it sounds competitive. It's perhaps a little bit competitive, but having said that, it's not really. It's just me and my friends playing some records and kind of having a bit of fun and having a nice evening, really. But I do like the idea of it's meant as a kind of an antidote to the idea that there are some record clubs where you go and listen to an album in silence locally, and it's all very chin strokey and kind of reverent. And this could not be any further from that, really. And I love it as a result. It's a lot of fun, and so I would recommend that people try this with their friends at home, because it is. I know that we have a number of listeners that, like me, disregard your anti-record bias and are very into it, and it's loads of fun, and we tweet about them, and the chap that runs it, the couple that run it, Paul and Catherine, always make sure everyone leaves with a quote-unquote prize. I have a Dennis Waterman album that I haven't played yet. We did all get given a copy of No Parlay by Neil Young with his extraordinary cover of Love Will Tear Us Apart on it. Paul Young.
Yes,
Bob Young's, you see, I would like to hear Neil Young doing Love Will Tear Us Apart, but Paul
that
Young
would
be lovely something. Terrace party is an altogether less pleasant experience. I like the idea of the communal listening experience, but with less of the beard stroking and chin stroking that suggests.
Now, that sounds really good. And when I saw that we were going to be talking about this, it just reminded me, it took me back in time to the 1970s, because in a similar fashion, John Peel and John Walters and their wives organised a weekly get-together based upon merging supper with media, except we didn't call it media in the 1970s. Mm. When I worked with them, or I think more accurately, when I hung around and got in the way as a young boy, John Walters had the tiniest office in Broadcasting House. It almost certainly, quite genuinely, had been a storage room, a broom cupboard. And bearing in mind he was the untidiest man in the universe, there was one desk in this tiny, tiny room with piles and piles of papers and records on it, and there was one chair. And Walters was, at that time, he'd taken over from Bernie Andrews, he was John Peel's producer.
Yeah.
And John Peel would sit on the floor, and Walter's secretary, Sue, and I would stand in the doorway because there was no space in the room. And at that time, my role was, I was booking John Peel out on his John Peel roadshow.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, it was my one of my jobs at the time. I booked him out at various colleges and universities. And I used to pop in to the BBC on a Thursday when the Radio Times came out. And that's a critical aspect of all this. He wanted me to come in on a Thursday with the radio, when the Radio Times was there, because on alternate Saturdays, Peel and Walters used to host a supper where the menu had to be inspired, quite similar to your idea, but just a little bit different. It had to be inspired by whatever movie the BBC was showing on that Saturday night. And whichever of them was the host used to secretly, they each thought, take Sue and me aside to try and dream up a clever plan to go one up on whatever the other had served the week before.
Of course. So you were double agents.
We were double agents. Spaghetti Westerns were easy, naturally. You know, Italian pasta would be provided. I remember, always remember, Cool Hand Luke led to Peel providing an accurate but really disappointing plate of hard-boiled eggs as the menu. Well, I think this weekly contest ran for about a year before they all got fed up with it. And instead of being a sort of culinary feast, it descended into a sort of table of inedible food as they ran out of ideas. And I remember, the other one I remembered was a real low when pudding was tinned plums with custard, because Christopher Plummer was starring in The Sound of Music on BBC. Yeah, exactly. So
I think that's quite nice.
I imagine these days you can just call Deliveroo or Uber Eats to get food tailored to any movie you're watching, or indeed any music you're playing.
Well, there's a business idea there if you can't, surely. I am now, I have to say, when I was speaking of food themed to things, when I was a struggling and not very good stand-up a few years ago, I used to do a little thing about the meat van. So if you went to Rye Market on a Thursday, which really was the place to go in Rye and still is, they had this bizarre kind of van that was looked like a catering van, because it had a sort of a counter on it and a window, but it wasn't, because they used to do this bizarre meat raffle from it. I thought it was like a butcher's selling van, but they used to kind of whip people up in the crowd. So there'd be a crowd of about 30 people all gathered around the meat van, and it would almost kind of be like horse racing commentary, that a guy would literally get on the mic and go, "Oh, I've got this lovely leg of lamb for you. Leg of lamb, leg of lamb, leg of lamb, £20, £90, £80, £70 a bit." And it was like horse racing. And it was almost, I mean, people would go wild and sort of start just gesticulating, and then they would, whoever it was that won the lamb, they would then, it was like a tiny rock festival, because they would then throw the lamb out into the crowd, and it would crowd surf its way, this leg of frozen lamb, towards whoever it was that won it. And I, when I used to do stand up, I used to say it was like a rock festival. All the big acts played there. Steak That, Ham 69, for example. You can't stop me, Terrence. I'm on a roll, a sausage roll. I like the idea of theming, kind of theming things. And actually, I read about the John Peel, John Waters story that you told me, because in Margrave of the Marshes,
Oh, I haven't read this. This is his biography.
It's meant to be his autobiography.
Yeah.
But he finished it. Well, he didn't finish it. He died before he could finish it. So brilliantly, his wife, Sheila Ravenscroft, finishes it off for him. So it becomes then a biography of him. And it's a really lovely book. I mean, because the funniest thing is, and I don't know if this was deliberate because they edited it this way, but I think John Peel would have very much approved of the fact that his part of the book finishes with the sentence that someone offered the opportunity to take him to their favourite brothel, which he refused. Mm. And then it stops at that point. And I think it's Sheila that tells the story in this about how they used to do these theme evenings, and I think it was the Waters that played the trick on them, that they, for something like, it was either Ice Cold in Alex or something, they would whack the heating up, and they did, I think it was Lawrence of Arabia or something, I think it was this, they did this, apologies if I misremember this, but they did something which involved lots of desert, and they very, very, very subtly, the Waters, started to turn the heating up during the during the film, and it was very subtly done. And John and Peel and Sheila Ravenscroft realised they became very thirsty because it was very hot. Mm. And when they went to get a glass of water, they'd turn the water off. So I mean, it sounded like a lot of fun, and perhaps, you know, not entirely different to my friend Paul giving me -1 for Ghost Town because he didn't like the specials. So I love the idea of this kind of just fun, really. Just you know, consuming popular culture and making it fun and keeping it a kind of a communal experience, really. I read a really interesting piece today, again in the New Statesman by Caroline Crampton. It's in the latest issue is called The New Times, and it's examining kind of new trends. And one of them is the rise of podcasting. And obviously, we're very pro-podcasting because we do one. We like doing this. People listen. We love you for it. But she talks about how we're starting to move away from the communal experience of radio, because of course podcasts are designed, you know, dear listener, you might be ironing, you might be doing the washing up, you know, who knows what you might be doing, but you could easily be doing something else as well as doing this, or you might be shoved in a cattle class train with headphones on or something, so, or waiting for a train that will not come in some cases. So actually, in a way, although I think podcasting is great, and obviously I won't have a word said against it because it gives me a platform to be stupid every week, equally I hate the idea of us moving towards this fragmented experience, like Netflix as well, the idea that I love going into work the next day and talking to people about what's been on telly, to the point where me and my colleague that I work with are both big Broadchurch fans, and we're already scheduling Biscuit Club, which is a cup of tea and a biscuit at about, you know, 11 o'clock, to have a 10-minute chat about Broadchurch. And I love the idea of the communal experience and the communal enjoyment of media. So that's why I love daft things like Record Club and Film Club and stuff like that, because it still feels that we're having an experience together.
And other than supper clubs, are you playing music for the people this week, Jules?
The people. And I will be doing Saturday Social on Saturday night. Very much looking forward to that, on Papa H's birthday, no less. So he might have some input into the show, who knows. He's always talked up his harmonica playing skills, but I will try to discourage that wherever possible, unless he can do ABC by the Jacksons. So we're doing a Saturday Social, 6 to 7 p.m. barracadebrader.com. Indie Wonderland will be back next Wednesday. And I will talk about this now because in case we don't do the podcast, but for people that are southeast based, we often talk about the Delawarr Pavilion. All right. That are Wapping in Bexhill, the Grade 1 modernist masterpiece there, and great arts venue. Looking forward to seeing Jesus and Mary Chain and Maximo Park at separate points later this year, and they do all the National Theatre live screenings, have excellent exhibitions, and I very much enjoyed my Welsh rarebit and illy coffee in the cafe today, so it is all things to all people. They're doing a series, they do a series of talks, the head of learning and development there organises them, she works very hard on them, she pronounces it the proper Russian way, which is Pechakucha, but I pronounce it Pechakucha because I'm English and rubbish at these things. My mum said to me the other day, when are you doing your Pikachu talk, which I thought was quite... and the idea is that you have about 10 speakers each evening, and it's the idea is it's called an evening of thinking and drinking, who can't get behind that, and you have... give a talk of 6 minutes, 40 seconds. And the reason it is so precise in its timing is there's a big screen behind you that you've made a PowerPoint presentation for that shows 20 images that are up for 20 seconds each. So it's an incredibly prescribed way of talking. And I'm having to practice a lot because I'm doing a presentation. They're called presentations and we are presenters next week, next Thursday. So that's Thursday, the 2nd of March. It's from 7 to 9. They usually sell out. So if you do want to come along and you're in the local area, I'd suggest getting a ticket sharp as it's a fiver, which means it's 50p a speaker, and I have to say I think I'm cheaper, twice the price, and I'm talking about talking, so I'll be talking about being a little bit about being a lawyer and then being a stand-up and then how I got into radio and then how I got into doing this podcast, and there'll be a few thoughts about the power of speech and sort of what thoughts you need to be going along when you're speaking as well. So if anyone wants to come and see me do that, if you can't make it to beautiful Bexhill, they do get put up online afterwards, and we will link to that, I hope. So
definitely,
so
yeah.
These are my media appearances such as they are.
Oh, we'll break a leg with all of those for sure. Huge thanks to our Scottish Shakespeare, really, executive producer Rona. And as Jules said, thanks to you for listening, whether it's through the Parish Council website, iTunes, Rockin' Vicar, Podbean, or however you listen.
Or a pigeon that you have sent out into the ether to relay the messages back to you.
We're playing out this week with a band who have been in existence since 2005, but have only released three albums in that time. I've really enjoyed all three of those albums. And from the middle album of those three, here's one of my favourite tracks from the band. It was released as a single in June 2010. This is Cherry Ghost and Kissing Strangers.
On the chase. have been listening to a DACA Media production.
They said, would you like some pie? I said, yes, I would. I forgot they majored in math. I would undo it if I could. They said 3.14159 265 3589 793 2384 626433.